You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast, an evolving treatment landscape for eosinophilic esophagitis, an allergist perspective, which is hosted by Med Learning Group. My name is Dr. Nirmala Gonsalves. I'm a professor of medicine at Northwestern University, the Feinberg School of Medicine in Chicago, Illinois. With me today is Dr. Alex Horwitz, Associate Professor of Pediatrics and Medicine, Division of Allergy and Immunology at Penn State Health Children's Hospital in Hershey, Pennsylvania. In this episode, we'll be talking about the evolving treatment landscape for eosinophilic esophagitis, or EoE, including latest clinical evidence for biologic therapies from an allergist perspective. Welcome, Dr. Horwitz.
Thank you.
So let's get started. As an allergist, what is your approach to treatment when you are managing a patient diagnosed with EoE? What are the clinical guideline approved treatment options for EoE?
Yes, so there are three main treatment options that we talk about with patients. First, under sort of the medication kind of category, we talk about proton pump inhibitors or topical corticosteroids. And then we can also talk about dietary therapy. And then for certain subsets of patients, not generally in my pediatric population, dilations can also be considered if there are severe strictures. And the approach in some ways depends on how symptomatic a patient is, but a lot of it really is a discussion between the patient and their family and myself as to what therapies may work best for them. I generally do try to start with proton pump inhibitors as the first line, though in some certain circumstances, either a patient is not really interested in utilizing that medication, or if they're so symptomatic, I may do dual therapy, maybe with a proton pump inhibitor and a topical corticosteroid to start.
Okay, that sounds really interesting. So tell me, in your practice, what does that discussion actually look like? I know you mentioned that you were a pediatric allergist. So how does that discussion come into play with your patient, their parents, and how do you walk them through that?
Yes. So I lay out each of the options, and then I discuss a little bit about the pros and cons. One in terms of proton pump inhibitors and topical corticosteroids, those are medications. And some families prefer to use non-medication ways of managing, which then we would be pushing into the dietary therapy. Some families, you know, depending on what their ability is to maybe adhere to diet, or when we talk about maybe the challenges of adhering to some of these diets, which can be either fairly restrictive or be cutting out large major food groups, then they may think, well, maybe medication is not such a bad option. And then laying out, you know, pros and cons of proton pump inhibitors versus topical corticosteroids, and they can sometimes, you know, whatever they feel like would fit best for them.
Thank you for that background, Dr. Horwitz. In your clinical practice, what are the typical symptoms that you see with patients presenting with EoE?
Yes, it depends a little bit on the age group. In our very young children, we may just see recurrent vomiting or feeding refusal, where they're not progressing as they should be on introducing solid foods in the way that we would expect. And in the older sort of school age child, we tend to see more of the abdominal pain or more sort of reflux symptoms. And even at that stage, you can see some evidence of dysphagia, where they really have some difficulty swallowing, needing to make modifications in the way that they are eating or the foods that they are eating in order to be able to eat in a more normal way. And we've had, it's not an uncommon story that we have families talk about their children needing to either have the Heimlich maneuver multiple times or having to go to the restroom and bring up the food that they couldn't swallow. And there's sort of not a recognition that that might not be normal behaviors So that is quite commonly what we see.
Yeah, I think you're highlighting the natural progression of this disease from children at a very young age and then presenting and progressing more towards that adult phenotype where they start getting those self-limited food impactions where they have to oftentimes go to the bathroom to disimpact those food impactions. So really, this is a chronic and progressive disease. And then with that in mind, let's discuss the pros and cons of the standard treatment options before delving more specifically into the recently approved biologic therapy. So what are your thoughts on proton pump inhibitors, PPIs?
Proton pump inhibitors do work well for certain patients. You know, there is a variability in the response, both symptomatically and histologically. Histologically, maybe around 30 to 50%, but they are easily available. They are typically tolerated very well by patients. And generally, at least the short-term side effects are not really significant. So that tends to be why we like to use them as first line. And if someone responds to them, it's fairly easy to kind of continue that as maintenance therapy. People have heard about some of the longer term implications of using proton pump inhibitors, such as, you know, issues with bone density or, you know, different types of gastric infections and such things, and may be hesitant to use them long term. But I think it's a really nice option to start with to see at least if there is a response. Rarely we do see that they may stop working over time, but I personally haven't seen that often with the proton pump inhibitors.
So Dr. Horowitz, you mentioned something about response. How do you partner with your gastroenterologist to assess that response? Because as we know, just following patients based on symptoms is not enough.
We have a couple of different ways we can do that. So for our sort of routine patients who are not very complicated, what we typically do is we have a really good communication back and forth. And so if I am seeing the patient and initiating a treatment, then I reach out to the gastroenterology colleague who is caring for that patient and let them know that I am starting this. And then we would like to see an endoscopy in about 12 weeks, and then they then go ahead and set that up on their end. And then after they have the endoscopy, then the GI docs usually send the report to us and let us know. And then we come together and make a decision on next steps. We also have a multidisciplinary EOE clinic that we use for our more complicated patients, and then we can make sort of those decisions and then the plan in the moment with our GI colleagues being able to, you know, ask for a or put on their list that in such and such amount of time we're going to get an endoscopy.
Yeah, that's great. I think that partnership is really important, and I think highlighting to everyone that the use of endoscopy with biopsy after treatment changes is really important to assess disease activity and not just go based on that symptom improvement. And how about the usefulness of swallowed topical corticosteroids in treating EOE?
Corticosteroids can be very useful in certain patients. There, again, is, you know, an overall benefit, about 60 or 65% of response, both symptoms and histologically. The downsides for corticosteroid therapy sometimes is just the palatability. Some patients mixing the budesonide vials, they can't find anything to mix it with that they actually can handle the taste of, or they just don't like taking. I find that the inhaled fluticasone sometimes, the swallowed fluticasone sometimes gets inhaled, especially if we have patients who have concomitant asthma and are used to inhaling these medications. And so sometimes technique can be a barrier. There is the one major side effect that we talk to families about with the topical corticosteroids is the risk of esophageal candidiasis. And while it is possible, I actually have not seen very many patients have problems with it. You would expect, I think, more than we are actually seeing clinically. And most patients are okay with that potential risk, we explain to them what to look for and when to reach out to us. And we have had some patients that do stop responding to the topical corticosteroids after a period of time.
So Dr. Horowitz, that's interesting that you mentioned that as gastroenterologists, we also don't see esophageal candidiasis very commonly. The studies usually say anywhere from about 5 to 30% of patients, but we typically don't see it. It's usually asymptomatic. And when we do see it, it's during endoscopy and it's easily treated. So what do you think about dietary therapy?
Dietary therapy can be a really good option, especially in your very young children. It is harder as, again, in my population, as you get up into the teenage years, that can be a little bit of a harder thing for families to do. The challenges with dietary therapy is deciding on which one to utilize. There are lots of options out there that over the years some have been more utilized earlier on and now have fallen less in, more out of favor. Certainly in babies, you could do an elemental diet, which is very, very effective, but just very difficult to, do in older children. And you need to, do endoscopies repeatedly when you're introducing foods or groups of foods. When we talk to families, we're either talking about, my approach is talking about either a two food elimination diet, so milk and wheat. Rarely can people do a four food elimination diet, which is milk, egg, wheat, and soy. And occasionally, especially if you have a family that wants to try dietary therapy but doesn't feel that they can do more than one food, we start with milk because that tends to be the most common, especially in the kids. And then hopefully that will be the one that will work. And then we don't have to go further. The discussion really is, again, about the family, whether they feel that they could adhere to a strict diet. So it's talking about their lifestyle, their ability to really be very strict about this. If it's an older child, the parents feel that this is a good option, but you look at the 12, 13-year-old and they just are not going to be able to do it. They're not interested in, being at lunch in the cafeteria or going to their friend's house and having to say, no, I can't have this, or paying attention to what they can or cannot have. So I think for selected patients, it's a really good option, but they just need to really be able to take on that commitment to be able to do the diet.
Yes, I think you've highlighted the challenges of dietary therapy, particularly for children, where so much is involved with the socialization of eating. I deal with a primarily adult population, and so many patients are motivated to pursue this type of an option to, get to that root cause of the issue. But really what our approach has been is a shared decision-making discussion with that patient in terms of the different diet options that are available. We don't do elemental diet, and we usually don't do an allergy testing directed diet, but we'll do an empiric elimination diet. And as you point out, there's lots of different options with empiric elimination diets that can be discussed with patients. So there's really not a right approach. It's that shared decision with your patient. So thank you for that great overview. All right, now let's discuss the recently approved biologic therapy, dupilumab, and how it's changed the treatment landscape for these patients. Can you walk us through a little bit about the medication and the background?
Yes, so dupilumab has actually been used for a while now in a lot of different atopic diseases, such as asthma and atopic dermatitis. It is it's a human monoclonal antibody directed against the IL-4 receptor alpha chain. And so it blocks signaling of IL-4 and IL-13, which are key signaling cytokines for the eosinophils. And we've actually have had very good success with patients who have utilized this medication. The studies have shown excellent response rates versus placebo, both in symptoms and histology. And I've seen that borne out in practice. So it has been a game changer, I feel like, for those patients who we really are struggling getting good control with the traditional therapies or who are not tolerating them. It is given as in EoE is a slightly different dosing regimen than in some of the other atopic diseases. It is a weekly subcutaneous injection and tends to be well tolerated by patients for the most part. The one big side effect that I think most people talk about with dupilumab is the conjunctivitis that can happen. And interestingly, we don't see it for every indication that dupilumab is used for. So I'm not sure what it is about dupilumab and the interaction with the indication, but so far we have not seen it in our patients when we use it for EoE for some reason. Not to say that it could not happen, but I think we may see it less than other in other indications. And Dr. Gonsalves, I'm curious as to your perspective on dupilumab and what you have seen as the gastroenterologist.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. I really think that it has changed options for patients with EoE and that we now have an FDA-approved medication for this condition, which we haven't had previously. So that's very exciting. It, in the studies, has really shown excellent improvement in not only histology, the symptoms, and it's easy to administer for patients. I deal with an adult population, so they administer it themselves once a week. With good effect. I agree the side effects are very rare. Things that we see are arthralgias, reactivation of respiratory infections, injection site reactions. Those are probably the most common things that we're seeing in the clinical studies. And other things such as, you know, fevers, headaches, chills, and then the allergic conjunctivitis are also things to counsel patients on. But overall, it's been a very well-tolerated medication and a great addition to options for us to use for EoE. Can you discuss any new clinical trials of promising drugs in the pipeline?
There are actually several different biologic medications that are being looked at and are promising for EoE, either in phase two or phase three trials at this point. Some of the other anti-IL-5 medications, such as benralizumab and mepolizumab, which again have been used in other diseases such as asthma. Then there's also an anti-IL-13 medication, sindacamab, and an anti-TSLP medication, tezepelumab. And then another medication, Siglec-8 therapy, lirentelimab, is also being studied.
So that's really exciting. I think one of the great things about eosinophilic esophagitis is there are lots of different opportunities and targets and other things that are coming down the pipe for EoE. So we're eagerly anticipating the results of all these clinical trials.
Coming soon, we're going to have more directed therapies to help with EoE. And it's been great to see one so far and all of these new options coming out for our patients. It's a really wonderful time.
Thank you so much. That's all the time we have for today. I want to thank Dr. Horwitz for sharing her expertise and experience with us regarding treatment options for EoE in a real-world practice, including incorporation of a newly approved biologic therapy. And thank you for joining us. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essential. I want to give a special thank you to our supporters, Regeneron Pharmaceuticals and Sanofi, who provided an independent medical education grant for this activity.